Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. Additional support for The Pulse is provided by AstraZeneca and Independence Blue Cross.
Your phone number has been recorded as 21535158 90. If this is correct, press 1.
No, that is not correct. It's not even close to what humans sound like. Why is it so hard to get artificial voices right? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
The galaxy we live in is on a crash course with Andromeda.
Beep, beep. Yes, you dream about it.
Giraffes don't faint.
No, they don't.
You just go about your life, and you don't notice a thing because it's just you.
Don't be so occupied with what you expect out of it, because that's bad science.
That's sometimes not so easy for somebody to let go.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
What happened?
Tomato sort of hit me in the face.
Do I stop? Interrupt this task?
No, I've got it.
You're just going to have a new cane or cane. Stand in a position that's not right.
You know, MS is always going to be in your living room. It just shouldn't be in the center of your living room.
On today's show, Making It Work. Ranchers adjust to America's changing appetites. Californians contemplate life without lawns. And men start to talk about their feelings. Just don't say the word depression. But first up, we talk to artificial voices all of the time, checking our credit card balance, making an airline reservation, and ordering stuff.
Are you currently a customer?
Yes.
By customer, we mean someone who already receives deliveries of water.
Yes.
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
So it's a huge relief when a real person finally gets on the line, right? But then there's also Siri, the genie of the iPhone, and other talking devices that are so good it's tough to believe they are computer-generated. Replicating our voices with machines has been a long and hard pursuit for humans. As Pulse reporter Todd Bookman found, the quest goes back way farther than you might expect.
Sometimes living in a palace just isn't enough. Say you're a royal hanging out in the 18th century. You need food, you need wine, you need entertainment. Let's wheel in the Turk. In Central Europe in 1770, the upper crust found much enjoyment watching a machine made out of wood and metal play chess. As simple as that, a mechanical chess player who beat all comers.
It's now pretty well acknowledged that there was a concealed person inside of it, but it was done very ingeniously, so nobody was really able to expose it at the time.
The Turk consisted of two main elements, a wooden dummy draped in robes, donning a turban, and then this second sort of box, kind of like a cabinet, where a real-life chess master would hide. A complicated series of levers allowed him to move the Turk's arm, which moved the chess pieces. Dignitaries across the continent fell for this thing. Over the years, it would checkmate both Napoleon Bonaparte and Ben Franklin. The guy behind the prank was Wolfgang von Kempelen. And to help sell the ruse, he began working on another invention, a speaking machine.
I suspect that one of the reasons for it may have been to simulate speech to be used as part of the chess player, ideally speech that would sound a little bit inhuman, so that it would make the hoax all the more convincing.
This is Patrick Feaster from Indiana University. He's an expert on early talking machines and says Kempelen's speaking device used bellows like you'd use to stoke a fire. These were the stand-in for lungs, forcing air through a reed, which would vibrate like a voice box.
And so to play this device, which was enclosed inside a box, Kempelen would stick his hands through holes on the outside and then use his arm to manipulate the bellows.
We're hearing sound from a replica made in 2009. And that right there, Mama and Papa, is your 18th century synthetic voice. Kempelen's machine was understandably complicated to use and never made it into the Turk, but it did eventually expand its vocabulary.
So some of the most impressive words that people reported hearing it say were Mississippi, Constantinople, and Schachspieler, although that last one gave him some trouble.
What does that word translate to?
Oh, chess player.
Kempelen would spend decades tinkering and redesigning his speaking machine, And in 1791, he published a book on the mechanisms of human speech. It's possible Joseph Faber read that book.
Faber took this thing one step further than Kempelen had.
Faber was a German inventor who made big leaps in talking machine technology in the 1840s.
He finally managed to simulate all the speech sounds that he could think of, and then he connected the thing to a keyboard.
Faber called his invention the euphonia. He would sit at it like you would a piano, the bellows and levers and strings dancing under his fingers. He also, for some reason, thought it was a good idea to rig a female mask to the euphonia, so these strange sounds would seemingly pour out of her spooky, motionless face.
People at the time consistently remarked on the fact that it sounded very, very monotonous. So something like this, I am a machine. And this was very unsettling for people to hear. Nobody had really heard speech like that before. In fact, our modern notion of what robotic speech sounds like could probably be traced back to that point.
In the spring of 1890, another step forward. Thomas Edison's talking dolls brought real speech into the machine for the first time. But instead of producing sound, it played back recorded sound. The doll stood about 2 feet tall, pretty blue dress, blonde hair, and inside, a tiny phonograph player. Kids, rich kids, by the way, because these were not cheap, they would wind the device and hear a collection of nursery rhymes.
Difficulty, though, was that the machines easily got out of order. They didn't really work all that well. It was really an effort to use the technology for something it wasn't really quite equipped to do yet.
And it wasn't just that the Edison dolls didn't work well. The bigger issue was that when you did wind the figure at the exact right speed, this is what came out.
Not exactly soothing.
No, it may be a step above, now I lay me down to sleep. But, you know, if it's a matter of which is more likely to give a child nightmares, I think it'd be a toss-up.
The dolls were perhaps a bit ahead of their time. But that was exactly what people were going for at the World's Fair.
The World's Fair, the New York World's Fair of 1939.
Held in Queens, the theme was Tools for the World of Tomorrow.
And I declare it open to all mankind.
After FDR's christening, more than 44 million people came to see exhibits. Companies went all out to impress the audience. Bell Laboratories tried to trump everyone with their futuristic machine.
Helen, will you have the voters say, greetings, everybody? Now, will you have him repeat that in a high voice? And now, in his best bass.
After centuries of acoustic devices, the voter was the first speaking machine to rely on electronics. It still played like a piano. The operator would use keys to activate filters, which shaped a tone. Voter wasn't an easy thing to manipulate, but it was closer in terms of rhythm and pitch to how humans speak.
It wouldn't give people nightmares in quite the same way. It sounded like a much friendlier robot.
Voter would mark the start of the modern race for better sound generation. Processing power continued to advance, and before long, computers were synthesizing and creating voices. This is an IBM belting out Daisy Bell in 1961. In the decades since, the best talking programs have swung away from computer-generated sound and instead rely on actual human voices. The talking software of today start with an actor in a studio. He or she will read out a collection of words and sentences, which then get broken down into the most basic elements of language, called phonemes. In English, there's about 40 of them. Once all the phonemes are isolated, they can then be recombined to form, in theory, any possible word or sentence.
Well, I won't say anything you tell me to. I do have my limits.
Apple Siri is arguably today's best and most omnipresent talking machine.
Thanks for the compliment.
But as good as Siri is at combining phonemes, there's no way that voice could pass for a human one.
Your radio voice isn't all that good, either.
Deadpan is good for a dig, I guess, but the inability to stress words and vary timing demonstrate just how large the divide remains between the real and the simulated, between us and machines. Patrick Feaster from Indiana University says bridging that gap has motivated inventors for hundreds of years and will likely do so for many more.
So there'll always be two groups of people, I think. One that likes to point to certain things that machines will never, ever, ever be able to do and to value human beings more because of it. And then people who will look to those precise same things and look at those as the biggest challenges.
Speech is hard to solve. The voice is the thing which remains, for now at least, quintessentially ours. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
Weak science. That's what a British medical journal just said about the studies informing the creation of the next edition of the U.S. dietary guidelines. Remember the food pyramid, and now there's Choose My Plate. And a new version is due out in the fall. These guidelines have come under criticism before for being more politics than science. But no matter what people say about them, they are hugely influential in terms of what Americans put on their plates. The quest for lean proteins, as recommended in the 2010 edition of this manifest, for example, has changed the choices shoppers are making at the meat counter. And U.S. livestock farmers are adjusting. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports.
Steve Landers raises 100% grass-fed beef on the border of Boone County in central Missouri. There hasn't been much rain since June, so with a chorus of chirping insects as a backdrop, he's checking on his pastures and herd.
We're just going to go check over here to see if they are this direction or if they are that direction.
He finds a small group of red and white cattle huddled in a shady grove next to a small pond. They're whisking flies away with their tails and tongues.
These cattle right here, the 33 of them, are Hereford and Red Angus crosses.
Most cattle are fattened up on grain feed made from corn and soybeans and other supplements. But here at Coverdell Farm, Landers switched his cattle to a prefix menu of pure grass in 2007.
And then the customers started catching on to what we were doing. Oh, shoot, now we got more customers than we had beef. We bought more land. We got more cattle. We had more customers. And it just has stair-stepped its way up since then.
Grass-fed beef is leaner than most conventional varieties, and according to the Mayo Clinic, it generally has a little less fat, a few more vitamins, and more of those coveted omega-3 fatty acids. Landers points to those health benefits as part of the reason his business is maxed out with demand.
What I saw was a vast increase in the knowledge of the customer base. I mean, I know a little bit, but what they're telling me about CLAs and EPA and DHA, the omega-3 fatty acids that are essential, and it just goes on and on.
Indeed, Americans have been paying attention to what our doctors recommend when it comes to meat. The main recommendation?
There should be a shift from a meat-based diet or meat-centered diet to a more plant-based diet, which can also include some meat in the overall dietary pattern.
That's why researchers like Frank Hu study the health consequences of eating meat. He's a Harvard professor of nutrition and epidemiology.
In the Western population, especially in the U.S., red meat is the main source of saturated fat, dietary cholesterol, and also main source of human iron.
Hu says a heavy red meat diet has been tied to risks of diabetes, cardiovascular diseases, and certain cancers. That's in part why federal guidelines suggest eating proteins from a variety of sources, pushing poultry, fish, and nuts specifically. Joan Salgi-Blake is with the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics.
The guidelines initially were formulated to make sure that your diet was healthy so you didn't have any deficiencies.
Blake says scientists are still examining exactly what the American diet should look like. For example, what was originally called the meat group has now become the protein group. And most recently, the guidelines have focused on cutting down portion sizes in that group to 3 to 6 ounces a day.
You don't need to be eating a whole steak when you sit down for dinner. You can have some lean meat, and it can be fish, and it can be poultry, or it can be vegetarian source of protein, such as beans. But the issue is we don't need it covering the whole plate.
Consumers seem to be taking note, too. Beef consumption per person in the U.S. has been steadily declining for decades, and we eat more poultry, which is generally a leaner meat, now than ever before. Some of that has to do with prices and some with marketing, but we're also looking to go lean. Maureen Ogle is a food historian and author. She says we can actually see changing attitudes toward our meat in farm animals themselves.
The meat that you buy in the store now is absolutely been developed and bred specifically to give Americans the sense that they're eating healthy meat as opposed to unhealthy meat.
It's a shift created by a growing group of educated shoppers. And she says livestock producers have to pay attention to that change.
They've just got to obey market signals. They can't go out and just sort of randomly raise cattle and hope for the best because they're not going to find anybody to buy it from them.
While numbers on the grass-fed beef industry are spotty, it's still a small portion of the overall beef market. But researchers say it's growing. Farmer Steve Landers says demand is so strong for his beef that he and two other nearby producers barely have time to keep up with their current customers.
We are not even touching each other in terms of competition. We're all working together because we can't possibly grow enough 100% grass-fed beef to take care of the market.
Landers says he's out of room for more cattle, but he is looking at adding free-range chicken and grass-fed lamb, if that's what his customers want to eat. For The Pulse, I'm Christopher Husted.
Christopher's piece comes to The Pulse via our reporting partnership with KCUR in Kansas City. Today's show is about making it work, sometimes against great odds. Picture a herd of camels grazing peacefully on a mountain in Northern California, Bactrian camels with their two humps. They are part of Sacred Camel Gardens, a place where people can come on camping retreats to learn about human-animal interactions. Again, this is California. In September, a fast-moving fire threatened this peaceful scene. The Valley Fire in Lake County killed 4 people and destroyed over 1,200 homes. As it approached the Sacred Camel Gardens, Director Stuart Camps found himself facing a tough decision. He had no way of getting the herd to safety. He was only there with one other caretaker, Sarah Turtelot, and together they decided to stay with the animals come what may.
This is Baraka, and this is Katie, Akbar, Lotsi, and Pruni.
I woke up about 3 a.m., and everything was incredibly black. No sky, really, at all. And there was an incredible roar off in the distance, like a tsunami making its way towards us. I didn't at first know what the hell it was. I was sort of disoriented. It was like, the fire's gone. The fire's moved away. What the hell is this? And the camels were here with us. And we all just stood here waiting. And that was the scariest time for me because we couldn't see what we were dealing with and we didn't know what was coming. The camels all took off at one point and went down in the direction of the roar, which was not what we wanted. I had obviously expected a fire here at some point in time. It was inevitable. And with 18 camels and one camel trailer and one truck, I decided a long time ago that we will probably stay here. We put a lot of gravel down, extended it out a little way, and the camels congregate up here a lot, so they keep the grass down through the summer, and That was why I planted myself here, and was one of the reasons I didn't want to go down into the paddock to find them, because I wanted to, they would know I was here, and if I left, they would know I had left, and that could be disconcerting. And then light flames started cresting the ridges at the other end of the valley. We could see the humps through the, against the flames, making their way up through the field. And coming up with them was a whole host of rabbits running along in the along the pasture as well, among the camels. And then they got here, and we all just waited. And we just, all 18 camels and the two of us. And we watched with the camels the fire coming up the valley, and it looked like the flame was just reaching for trees and breaking necks and reaching for the next tree and snapping trees, and trees were exploding, and there were explosions off in the distance. You could hear propane tanks exploding and car alarms going off and tires exploding. So within a short period of time, we're standing here completely surrounded by flame. And a couple of times Sarah threw herself down on the ground here. I grabbed this tree here when the winds were whipping up, just because we didn't know how strong these things were. The camels were all holding each other, making sure everybody was safe. And there was no one was being hysterical. Nobody was being pushed aside. Everybody was being included, and everyone was being looked after. And then we watched the fire continue up the field here, and it just kept chewing up the forest here, and it left us. We realized at that point we were safe. We've got to repair a lot of fences. We've got to get the water going again, and tidy up. To be frank, I didn't know if we'd make it through, and I know Sarah wouldn't leave, and I wouldn't leave. Well, I've been with the camels now for 21 years. It's my life, and it would have broken my heart to have left and have them survive without me and not have been here to help them or to have perished. That would have been hard.
Stuart Camps from the Sacred Camel Gardens in Northern California recounting his decision to stay with a herd of Bactrian camels even as a massive wildfire raged around him. Suki Lewis produced this story. California's wildfires have been made more potent by the severe drought that has plagued the state for several years now. Governor Jerry Brown declared a state of emergency in January of last year, and since then, Californians have been mandated to use less water, and they've actually managed to do so. Joining us now to talk about what has worked in terms of cutting down water use is Molly Peterson. She's the environment correspondent at KPCC in Los Angeles, and she's been covering the drought crisis. Molly, thank you so much for being here.
Happy to be here.
Molly, how did Californians reduce their overall water use by 31.3% in July? How did that happen?
The shortest and best answer is they reduced it outside in their outdoor landscape irrigation. We're counting cities and we're counting what people do in their home water use. And the estimates are between 50 and 70% of home water use has to do with what people put on their landscaping. So people turn their sprinklers off.
That was it?
Well, it's a lot more complicated than that. I mean, we have been tracking, we've only started counting how much water people use in California more specifically since last year. We used to just have these overall numbers, and then the state made calculations that more accurately reflect what each individual house uses. So we know a lot more than we did a year ago. If you think about a hose and the nozzle of the faucet and then like the end of the hose, they used to count water just at the top of the faucet rather than at the end of the hose. Now they count at the end of the hose and they count every single blade of grass basically that that water goes on. They have as kind of an individual per person, per capita, per day standardized figure that they give to every single city.
How was the message brought to people and what motivated people to participate?
The conservation campaigns tend to involve goofy cartoon characters. Like there's one called The Drop in Los Angeles, and Moby makes music for The Drop. And The Drop has all these kind of like hipster messages about how you're supposed to cut back your water use.
We have a clip from one of the videos starring Drop, so let's take a listen to that.
It's time to ask ourselves, every time we go to use water, is this good use of our friend? Let's turn this one-sided relationship around. Start with shorter showers, and fixed faucets, and beautiful California-friendly landscapes.
And the advice goes on and on, but it is really catchy and well done.
The history of animated campaigns related to drought in California is probably its own graduate school thesis of some sort. And then cities have also been pricing water differently since the drought started. There's something called conservation pricing or tiered pricing, where they sort of settle on a budget, sort of an idea of an amount of water that would be a sensible amount for people in a region to use. When you use more than that, the water starts costing more. And people respond to that sort of pricing, they believe.
Sometimes we see this kind of thing almost become a positive competition where people want to outdo each other, where the spirit spreads in communities. Let's do this and let's do it really well. Did you see that in any towns, communities?
One community I can think of is the city of Long Beach, which is one of the largest cities in Los Angeles County. They, like other cities, participated in something called Cash for Grass. Basically, people were paid between $2 and $4 a square foot to replace lawn, to replace regular old grass with drought-tolerant landscaping, Mediterranean or native plants from California.
Have any big companies come up with innovative ways to cut water use?
I can think of a few different things. You've seen golf courses in Southern California replace everything that you don't need except, you know, you obviously need greens, but you don't need greens all around the edge. So they've replaced their landscaping, and they've relied on recycled water or purple pipe water, water that is not drinkable but is safe enough to put on landscaping. This is a great time for entrepreneurs from Israel and from Australia, two countries that have a lot of experience with drought and with water shortages. There's the idea of recycling gray water at your home.
What about desalination?
A desalination plant in Santa Barbara that was built during the last major drought in 1992 almost immediately was closed because it wasn't financially feasible to continue operating it. Now there's an effort underway to reopen that plant. Also, further down Southern California in San Diego County, there's another desalination plant that's coming online. Both of those plants have had to contend with strong interests represented also in the state of California for protecting coastal environments, protecting coastal waters. And so desalination remains a complex bet. The money of it just doesn't work out much of the time.
What's the big picture thinking? Are people adjusting to this drought as perhaps a reality that's here to stay? What are farmers doing? Are people really changing the way they are living?
I think in urban areas, we still call the rules that we're living by under the drought emergency regulations. While there's no immediate expectation that the drought's going to end, the authorities have been asking people to save water, are nervous about what happens when we have El Nino this winter. We don't know what El Nino is going to look like in California. We suspect it's going to involve strong rains, certainly in Southern California, whether or not the precipitation in the far northern part of the state is going to build up enough snowpack remains to be seen. It's very unlikely we're going to be out of a drought before next year. And so the drought is going to continue, but whether or not people are willing to think of it as something that's permanent it's not really clear that that's the case at all. On the other hand, we've added rules that we've never had before in California. You asked about farmers. Farmers pump groundwater out of wells, and we haven't counted how much water they pull out of groundwater aquifers so far ever in the history of the state of California. We're now doing unprecedented things to count how much water farmers take out of these groundwater aquifers and other people. And so some of these changes of how we look at water are going to be permanent ones.
Molly, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Molly Peterson is an environment correspondent at Southern California Public Radio. Come on. Listening to The Pulse, I'm Mike and Scott. Our theme today is making it work. But how do you do that when the very basis of your livelihood is vanishing? That's what the lobster men of Long Island Sound are facing. They once pulled a couple million pounds of lobster out of this Atlantic Ocean tidal estuary, but now they're lucky if they get 10% of that, because most of the Sound's lobster population has disappeared. Lobstermen, fishery managers, and scientists are scrambling to discover the source of the die-off and to figure out what can be done to aid the lobster's recovery. Eilish O'Neill reports from Southeast Connecticut.
Eddie Emery's pulling his boat into the Stonington dock. It's called the Jill and Jacob after his son.
This is a very typical Down East style lobster boat. If you're looking for a lobster boat, the most efficient speed, stability.
Emery's a third-generation lobsterman. He's young, only about 40, but his face is sea-worn. He often wears a bright orange rubber apron while working alongside his father and his brother. A couple days ago, they took their lobster pots, these are 4-foot by 3-foot wire cages, and baited them with dead fish, tied them together in long lines of 7, and then placed them on the floor of the Sound in the hope that a lobster would crawl in.
Probably the most important piece of equipment on a lobster boat is a depth finder. Lobsters like variations in depth. Rock piles, wrecks, that's where they are. So you got to be able to find those.
Today, Emery pulled his last couple lobster pots out of the water. That's because starting 2 years ago, the Connecticut Department of Environmental Protection has been shutting down lobstering for the winter to try to give the species a chance to recover. Because of the shutdown, Emery's had to get a winter job delivering home heating oil.
Shutdown? Who cares? What shutdown? We're already shut down. Mother Nature shut us down. Lobsters are gone. The water has warmed. They're heading off to colder water.
There used to be hundreds of lobstermen working on Long Island Sound. Now, there are fewer than 100. Mike Grimshaw is the president of the Southern New England Lobstermen's Association. He's perhaps the last remaining fisherman south of Cape Cod who ekes out a living solely from lobsters.
Best week in life, all this round. I was just shy of 14,000 pounds for a week. But I'll never see a day like that. I can't imagine. The illusion of saying I'm a full-time lobsterman is gone.
In the late 1990s, there were more lobsters than ever before in Long Island Sound. And then, suddenly, they all disappeared, mysteriously killed by an unknown force. Some say it was pollution, others climate and predators. Antoinette Clementson, the fishery specialist at the New York Sea Grant, says chemicals from plastics could have played a role.
Chemicals that are known as algae phenols, which are found in plastics, do have an effect on the juvenile hormones that control, you know, basic biological functions such as growth and molting and development.
Another factor is climate. Since the late 1990s, the temperature of Long Island Sound has been creeping steadily upward, says Dave Simpson, a biologist and the director of marine fisheries at Connecticut's Department of Environmental Protection. And lobsters are a cold water species.
There's a reason why you don't find lobsters in inshore waters of New Jersey and Virginia and Maryland and North Carolina. They can't live there. It's too warm. And what we're finding is we're getting very, very close to that in Long Island Sound.
In Maine, where the water's colder, lobsters are thriving. But in southern New England, they're suffering. When the water reaches 68 degrees Fahrenheit, lobsters become weak and limp and susceptible to disease and predation. Back in the 1980s and 90s, the average water temperature of Long Island Sound was that hot only about 40 days a year. Since 2000, though, the average temperatures hit 68 degrees about 70 days a year, nearly twice as often. These warming waters bring with them another challenge: favorable conditions for the fish that love to feed on lobsters, especially when they're sitting in a lobster trap.
I remember being a little kid, you see a fish come up in a trap, it was a big deal. Oh my God, what kind of fish is that? Now, like, the traps are absolutely overrun with fish.
The government's trying new tricks to protect the lobsters. In addition to shutting down lobstering in the winter, fisheries managers have reduced the number of pots lobstermen are allowed to put in the water. And they tried out a program to pay lobstermen to mark females and throw them back. Dave Simpson with the Connecticut DEP says the main challenge is figuring out how much lobstering to allow.
What should our expectations be? Certainly, it's not getting back to 1 million pounds, 3 million pounds of landings for Connecticut a year. But is the population able to support a 200,000-pound fishery or a 50,000-pound fishery? Or is that even too much? Whether there'll be anything left is uncertain.
We need to do a better job protecting this resource. Definitely. We're dropping the ball. Connecticut's dropped the ball for 15 years. My nephew was born on the 18th. I'd like to think that someday he'll be down here hauling lobster gear and making a living doing it. I want this dock here to be here forever.
Emery says the government should take more steps to reduce pollution in the Sound and allow fishermen to catch more of the sea bass and scup that are preying on lobsters. Then, he says, the lobsters might have a fighting chance of survival. For The Pulse, I'm Alicia O'Neill.
I fell into the ocean, and you became my wife. Rested all against the sea to have a better life.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mikan Scott. Today's show is about making it work, and this next story is a look at how it's sometimes hard to practice what you preach. A recent national survey found that there is no difference between the number of men and women who experience depression, but you wouldn't know it from looking inside a therapist's office. Women are still twice as likely to be diagnosed with depression as men. Mental health care providers say there's probably a complicated mix of stigma, gender bias, and concepts of masculinity at play. And sometimes even men who are spreading the get help message are not very good at actually doing so themselves. Renee Gross reports from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Okay, I need to stretch.
I know he's going to stretch.
Yeah.
He's the stretching guy.
Yeah. Four close friends are meeting up to go on a walk at Lily Park in Ann Arbor, Michigan. They try to walk as often as they can, despite their busy lives.
Oh, see, and I actually have to leave early because I don't want to get too much in shape.
Yeah, we're used to that.
That's Harold, or Woody Neighbors. He's a professor of public health at the University of Michigan. And this is not just a walk. It's an opportunity for Neighbors to talk openly about what's happening in his life, what's on his mind. He hasn't always been good about opening up to his friends about emotional issues.
I was worried that they would somehow think less of me as a, you know, competent, strong individual.
Neighbors should know better. He's been conducting focus groups with African-American men coping with depression as part of an ongoing study. Ironically, he's been telling these men to ask for help. But it wasn't until something terrible happened in his own life that he understood how difficult it really is to reach out.
My daughter passed away unexpectedly.
Neighbor's daughter, Camelia, died from a heart attack. She was only 33 years old and getting a PhD at the School of Public Health, the same school where Neighbor's teaches.
So, yeah, she was in the building and we'd see each other. After she passed away, it was probably a good 6 or 7 months before I could set foot in this building.
Still, Neighbors was determined to get back to work. He made plans with students to get together everywhere on campus, just not the public health building. But his grief was overpowering.
And some days I really felt like I was just walking around in a somewhat of a daze. You know, things were just a little fuzzy. I'd be in conversations with some of my students, and I would have this sensation that I had drifted off somewhere while they were talking.
Neighbor says he would wake up in the morning and not want to get out of bed.
I started experiencing, you know, just really symptoms of fatigue, rumination.
Neighbors talks about feeling tired and not being able to concentrate. Maybe you've noticed he's not used the word depression. That's pretty common, says Dr. John Sonega. He's the director of the University of Michigan Stress Management Program.
Men will say, I'm tired and I'm not really engaged in work. And we might not interpret that as depression.
Sonega says depressed men are also more likely to report aggression, substance use, and violent behavior to mental health professionals. That has researchers wondering, is this really depression or is it something else?
Are we assessing the right thing? Are the men actually depressed and we're just not calling them depressed?
Recognizing men as depressed is still only half the battle. Men are less likely to get diagnosed with depression than women, but they are also much less likely to seek help.
Because they face three stigmas, the stigma of mental health, the stigma of masculinity, and the stigma of work. And in all three of those, you're not supposed to talk about your emotions, not at work, not if you're a man, you know, and then not about mental health in particular.
Sonega says men have to learn to talk about their emotional health so that when they do experience difficulties, they know how to reach out and talk about what's going on with them rather than bottle up their feelings. For Woody Neighbors, during that difficult period after his daughter's death, it took him a long time before he felt comfortable to ask for help.
Wow, it was a good 5 months, 5 to 6 months.
At this point, the pain became too much for him.
This is something that I really don't think I can just carry all by myself.
So Neighbors reached out. He started individual counseling. He told people at work about his depression and took a medical leave. Most importantly, he says, he called up his best friends and asked them for a favor.
Would you two agree to form a walking group with me? We need to walk minimally once a week, maybe twice a week.
His friends happily agreed to walk with him. And while he walked, he talked. That, combined with the counseling and the medical leave, helped Neighbors get through his grief. This was years ago. But to this day, he still walks with his friends. And they talk about everything. Here's his walking buddy, Wayne McCullough.
I broadcast to everybody. Actually, my wife almost cringed because of how much people know about us.
For The Pulse, I'm Renee Gross.
This report was part of a special Scattergood Foundation grant for reporting on mental health issues. You're listening to The Pulse, and we're exploring how people make things or their lives work on today's show. Joseph Barnes was constantly sick as a child, and eventually he became withdrawn from school and life. And as a teen, his family doctor prescribed anti-anxiety medications, which helped him function much better. But he ended up getting hooked, and what followed was a 30-year cycle of addiction that destroyed his marriage and landed him in a homeless shelter. He told us his story for our series Patient Files, and he also explained how he began the journey to sobriety.
You know, my childhood started off well. Then I got, you know, really sick with a lot of asthma problems, pneumonia, almost died. And then the illnesses came. I used to be rushed to the hospital in the middle of the night, an ungodly amount of times. I couldn't tell you how many times, just consistently being under the oxygen tent there, just consistently being in the hospital. And, you know, as a kid, that takes so much out of you physically and emotionally. I fell into sort of a depression. Didn't like being around people, didn't go to parties, didn't want to go to school. I slacked in schooling a great deal because I was depressed. So I went to a family doctor. He prescribed the drug called Valium, and boy, did I feel different. I was 16 or 17. When a person's been anxious all of their life, you figure, hey, this is pretty cool, you know. Maybe I'll just take one more. Maybe the next day I'll just take two more, you know. I was taking street drugs, marijuana, a little bit of beer, with the volumes. And it felt good. I felt relaxed around people. I felt more competent, more assertive. I had no idea the repercussions. I just wanted to feel good. And I continued the volumes for a long period of time with marijuana and alcohol, and then it was powder cocaine with that as well. But see, I was functional. Dysfunctional, but I thought I was functional because I held a job. I was good at what I did. I thought when you hit rock bottom, that's a bum in the street. If I'm working every day, then I'm okay. At the age of 26, I got married. I met a girl who just liked who I was. We were working at the same job together down in Center City. A very sweet girl. I started taking Xanax. I went to a psychiatrist and got Xanax. Boy, did I love the way they made me feel. I started selling the Xanaxes. When I was selling them, I wasn't taking them as I should have been taking them. And I was going through the withdrawal. I didn't know much about withdrawal, so I needed that medication. You know, I needed it real bad there. When you're stealing from your wife to get high, and you've told her time and time again you're going to stop, and then you can't, person gets fed up. 18 months ago, I knew I had to get off the Xanax, but how do I do it? I was staying with a cousin. Then I had to leave. I called up different relatives. They didn't have any room. So I left. Went to a shelter. I couldn't believe where I was. I went to the shelter with a mindset. Look, tell them what's going on. I had maybe a month's supply of Xanax left. Then I said, you know, I got to come off from gradual. They weaned me off of the Xanax and gave me Ativan. That was the start. They prescribed me with a drug called Zoloft. I take it as prescribed. I go to regular therapy sessions twice a month, drug programs as well. And it's made me stronger. It's given me 18 months clean, and I wouldn't trade that for anything.
Jeanette Woods produced this piece.
Out of my head, it's glowing.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, our associate producer, Joel Patterson, the managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? Just subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes and on our website at whyy.org/thepulse. And hey, before we go, are you excited to see The Martian with Matt Damon? It's coming out this weekend. NASA collaborated on the movie, and now there are some rumors that the announcement confirming that NASA found evidence of water flowing on the surface of Mars was timed to coincide with the movie's release. NASA says no, of course, but they have been blogging about the film a lot and the real, already existing technologies you can see in the movie. To get us all in the mood, here's a little clip.
So, in the face of overwhelming odds, I'm left with only one option. I'm gonna have to science the shit out of this.
That's what we try to do on The Pulse every week. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca strives to create a culture where employees are excited by their work, have a clear sense of purpose, and display confidence in their ability to meet challenges and seize opportunities. More at AstraZeneca.com/careers.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.